This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
For almost 60 years, one of New York City's top Catholic high schools has been accepting and educating some of the city's top students, as long as they were boys. That all changed last year.
We were waiting for the end of the world. We were prepared for Armageddon. And when the girls came in, they were kids. They were teenage kids.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll visit Severian High School in Brooklyn to hear how they changed a half-century-old tradition of same-sex education. We'll also hear how a Catholic school in Detroit makes getting a job part of a student's homework. And we'll spend an academic minute with a whole lot of single people, really happy single people. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In the fall of 1957, Severian High School, a private Catholic high school, opened in the Bay Ridge neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York. It replaced St. Michael's Diocesan High School. The school was founded and is still sponsored by the Severian Brothers, and from its very first day has been an all-boys school. But in the face of changing demographics and economics, the school welcomed its first female freshman last September. And before we go any further, I have a confession. This is full disclosure. I'm interested in this school's transition because it's my alma mater. When I graduated sometime in the last millennium, it was still an all-boys school. So this summer, I took a trip back to visit and find out how that first co-ed year went. I sat down with the principal, Deacon Kevin McCormick, in his office. And no, not my first visit to that office. We were joined by Stephanie Lorenzo, the school's director of communications. McCormick has been principal for 9 years, long before the transition to co-ed. We talked about how and why the school made the change.
It started when we began to look at where we were and where we were going. The population of this area is not what it was during the boomer's time. And we began to see a steady, regular decline of available students. The school actually had turned into a situation where we had increased our academic expectations and discipline. We were in a really good place. There just weren't the boys here to do that. So we began to wonder where we could go. Can we go into Manhattan? Can we go into Nassau County? And the transportation reality makes that prohibitive. So then we said, why don't we start to think about the sisters of the men that we have here? And up until that point, that had been almost a taboo question. But different times demands different thinking, and we began to challenge ourselves and ask the question.
And when was that?
I would say we started about 2012. We worked with the Board of Trustees. They were very cautious. And rightfully so, and said we have to make sure we're not jumping into something we're not prepared for, and we had to do our homework.
Okay, well, let's talk about the homework. What type of research did you do? Who did you talk to?
Well, we began to talk to experts about the geographic and the population of the area and our surrounding feeder schools. We began to look at the impact it would have on the other schools that were here. There's a finite amount of people. If we take 100 kids, that means they're not going to other schools. We began to look at the implications that would have with the diocese and making sure the bishop, we had his blessings. We wanted to make sure we would have the facilities here to meet the needs of the young ladies and to make sure that they would never, ever be considered second-class citizens.
Just a quick aside, what's the percentage of Catholics that go here?
I'd say we're about 80%, and we're about 95% Christian. We have a strong, proud Greek Orthodox community. We have a handful of Protestants, and then we have a few Muslims and Buddhists, and once in a while a Jewish boy or girl comes in, and that's about makes up our school.
So you're doing a lot of talking. When did it finally go and start getting serious in front of the board?
When we began to realize that it made sense, especially for the future of the school, that for the school to be able to continue to do the things it was doing, and also realizing we felt that the other schools around here were not offering what we could offer to these young ladies. We began, I guess, about 2013, early 2014, to begin to put this into motion.
People talk. When the word started getting out, what was the initial reactions just around the campus?
There were actually two. There were people who kind of said, this is inevitable. Let's do it. And they would be inevitable in the sense of, well, there's nothing we can do, or inevitable, like, this is great. And then there were others who were saying, like, this is the end of the world, and we can't let it happen, and we're going to fight the power. And that was actually those guys that were involved in that. I feel for them because they didn't want to lose the brotherhood that was here. It wasn't that they had anything against the girls. They didn't want to lose the unique relationship that the guys here have.
Being a teacher here for 12 years and being a teacher to the all boys population, you know, I was kind of on the front line when things, word got out. And my response to them, and it kind of soothed the waters a little bit, was, you know, if I'm in the room with them every day and I consider myself part of this family, part of this quote-unquote brotherhood, you know, what's the difference? Because I think in a lot of ways, the boys were looking at the brotherhood the same way the word became interchangeable with family, with community, camaraderie. It wasn't necessarily a gender-specific thing, and I think they saw that in the relationships they had with females already in the building. It was easier for them to kind of digest that way, I feel.
How many female teachers were there at the time?
We're pretty split. It's about half and half, I would say.
So when I came here, there was zero.
Really?
Yes.
Really? No, we're about 50-50, maybe even in the majority now.
So what were the logistics once it went to the board? What were you talking about then beyond getting students? I mean, I imagine there was a lot of infrastructure you had to take care of.
That was the key. Curriculum's curriculum. Boys and girls learn science and math and English and religion the same way. But they needed facilities to go to the bathroom, to be able to shower. They needed their own locker rooms. And this takes money and it takes effort. We had a school that was when it was built for a population of virtually 100% male, and now we had to be able to make sure that people could take care of very basic needs everywhere that's, you know, reasonably within the building.
When did the decision come down, and how long did the implementation start?
We began in the fall of 16. That was the first time they came in. It was announced in the fall of 15, and I remember the board meeting. It was the spring of 15, and I remember tweeting out to the administration and to my friends that we had crossed the Rubicon. That was the model I had used, and I took, you know, like 2 years of Latin 1, so I'm a big Latin fan, and that one I had to look it up 5 hours on how to say it correctly in Latin, but that was the key. So I guess it was the spring of 15. The decision had finally been made. We had done our work. We had done our due diligence, and then the next year, under Mr. Lisi's leadership, our president, we got the construction taken care of. We made sure that we worked with the students and the faculty and the parents and the alum to be able to welcome these girls here and do so with open arms.
I think I'm going to go over to you, Stephanie, because you had made the decision you're going to let these girls in. You had to go out and tell the girls, hey, you're welcome now. Come on in. What kind of a job was that?
It was partly grassroots, I think. The word was spreading. You know, for a metropolitan area, we live in a very small town. And word in Bay Ridge got out quick. And started small. They were invited to open houses. They came on buddy days. And little by little, I think things fell into place. We had the right kind of advertisements at the right kind of time. And that open house was our biggest we had ever seen. So people were interested. They wanted to see what we were all about because for so long this was a quote-unquote boys club.
Because when you think about it, you only really had 1 year, less than a year really, to convince girls that now you've got another choice.
Right. One thing I think we should point out is that we have a middle school here also, and that was co-ed. So we did have 6th, 7th, and 8th grade girls in the building. Small number, maybe about 40 of them in each grade. So it wasn't completely foreign, and we also had people who then had a certain inkling or a bias towards us. So they became a foundation, but they don't represent the majority of the girls who came here. And in the first year, we had approximately 40% of the incoming class as girls.
40% the first year, that's something.
Yeah, Zavarian has spent, again, under Bob Alisi's leadership, we've really made an emphasis on making sure STEM is a big part of what we do and our Catholic identity. Those are the two foundations of what this school is based on. And we've made that very clear. And not that the other schools don't have them, but we do it in a unique way that at least right now seems very attractive to a lot of people.
Did you accept any upperclassmen, like someone who transferred from another school and say, I want to come here as a junior?
No. We started out that you had to be a member of the freshman class to enter. So now we would accept sophomore transfers because there will already be girls in that class, but an upperclassman cannot come.
Speaking of upperclassmen, you had guys who came in here as freshmen saying, I'm going to go to 4 years of an all-boys school. Then halfway through, they said, wait a minute, what's going on? Did you get any pushback from those students?
I don't think there was necessarily pushback. You know, I think that was one, personally, it was something that I was interested to see how it would play out. But I think so many of the boys and a number of really key players in those upperclassmen years, the junior and senior year, had sisters, little sisters that were now freshmen. And it was really just a nice thing to see where they were very accepting. And I think one of the biggest attributes to that was our athletics here. I think really, you know, calmed, not even calmed, but our athletic program on the girls' side, we had boys taking buses, you know, an hour away to go cheer them on. So it's quite a nice thing to see when you have a stand full of boys cheering on the freshman girls soccer team. And they were able to get into it that way. So it really molded itself nicely into one large family.
Were you able to establish athletic programs from the get-go?
Oh, yeah. I say oh, yeah, because our girls have, you know, I'm always proud of our boys, but I'm very proud of our girls after this year. We have a JV city soccer championship. Our JV basketball girls team went to BQ champs. Our varsity girls lacrosse team beat seniors in the city to win the championship. So we held our own, and we held it pretty well.
So talking about the boys' support of the girls' team, our volleyball team, which they did a good job, but they were going against girls who were older. And anyway, I'm in my office one day, and a kid comes bursting in my office, and he screams, Mac, you have to come downstairs. There's an emergency. So I said, what's going on? You know, I panic. And he goes, Fontbonne is here. So he's like, well, what does that mean? So he said, well, what happened was they had brought a bunch of their girls to support their team. So it was about 150, 200 Fontbonne girls here. And to be honest, JV volleyball may not be the most exciting and attractive sport to, you know, to bring people down. But this kid was like Paul Revere running around the building. He said to me, can I take the kids out of detention and let them come down too? So he went around and he says, we got to support our sisters. So we went down and we had a reasonable group of guys there, and mainly guys supporting their little sisters. I think ultimately we lost the game, but we were formidable, and I was very proud of the fact that the guys were protecting their sisters.
Still to come, our conversation about Severian High School continues with a look at how going co-ed increased the competition to get into the school. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Today we're talking about Severian High School in Brooklyn, New York, a Catholic high school that for its first 58 years was an all-boys school. That changed last fall. We're talking about the transition with Severian's principal, Deacon Kevin McCormick, and the school's director of communications, Stephanie Lorenzo.
This was always a very competitive school to get into. Is it more so now that guys have an entire new population to compete against?
Sure. In fact, we've raised our standards over the last 3, 4, 5 years, even before the girls came. There had been a time where the philosophy of the previous administration was one that we have to fill the seats. Under our administration now, we have to fill the seats with qualified people. And now, if we have a 50 or 60th percentile of acceptance, now you have boys and girls competing for that. And it has significantly raised the academic quality of the children that come here.
Is there a future for same-sex Catholic education, either in New York City or anywhere?
Sure there is. And, you know, what we're not looking for is a monolith. For Severian High School, at this particular time and place, it made a lot of sense for us. There are other schools that have dedicated themselves to the idea of same-sex education, and it makes sense. I understand their arguments. And many parents and kids are attracted to that. I think you can see that the tendency from an economic point of view is more and more of a co-ed situation, that single sex comes at a price in a population that's becoming less Catholic. We have a lot of Middle Eastern Arabs in this neighborhood. We have a lot of Chinese in this neighborhood that weren't here when you were a kid. And they don't have the same bias for Catholic education. So again, a lot of this is going to determine on economics. It's also going to determine on the ability to sustain the identity and make sure you get the resources that are needed for our kids to be good, educated people in the 21st century.
What's the situation with Catholic grade schools in the city? Are they still your prime feeder, or just take from anybody?
We have about 50-50 split. We certainly love our parochial schools, and parents sacrifice a great deal to go there and to come here, and that's to be commended. But we also have about 50% of our kids that come from public schools.
Are there many still parochial schools in the city?
Yeah, but they're shrinking. In the Southwest, completely different, because Catholic schools are booming down there. The Catholic population is exploding and building is going like crazy.
So finally, what surprised you about this? What did you learn that you didn't expect to learn?
I think some of the things that we found were the ease that this was. I mean, we were waiting for the end of the world. We were prepared for Armageddon. You know, the apocalypse was prepared. And when the girls came in, they were kids. They were teenage kids with what you expect. I have three daughters. I know what teenage girls are like. My girls are all adults now, but I know what they're like. And I know what adolescent boys are like. And they're not aliens, although they do appear to be so sometimes, at least my daughters did. But the reality is that they were kids. They want what's best. They want a place that they can feel at their home, a place that will protect them and challenge them. And I think Severian has done that really, really well. And it starts with the boss and his idea and his mission. And then the rest of us kind of buy into it and we promote it. It's supported by a board of trustees. It's certainly supported by our parents. And the overwhelming majority of the kids the metaphor for this place is, this is our family. This is our home.
I think just to repeat the sentiment that Mac did, you know, no matter what, who we're letting through the doors, two things remain and they stay unchanged to me. And it's the quality of what we offer and our values. You know, our values have not changed because of the type of person that crosses the threshold on the stairs on Shaw Road. And I think that remains true. So I think there is that connection for somebody from, you know, let's say the class of 74 or the class of 2001 or somebody who graduated yesterday, no matter what, girl or boy, there's still things that we believe in because we belong to a part of this. So I think that's really what has made it so easy. We haven't wavered in that regard.
Deacon Kevin McCormick is the principal of Severian High School in Brooklyn, New York, and Stephanie Lorenzo is the school's director of communications. Me, I'm Bob Barrett, class of 74. School is back in session around the country, but one Detroit high school is still celebrating its last graduating class. The entire class was accepted to college. Nearly all of the students live in poverty, and most of them are the first in their family to go to college. For Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project, Jennifer Guerra tried to find out the secret of the school's success.
4 days a week, Idalis Longoria does what pretty much all high school juniors do. She goes to school, takes notes in class, hangs out with her friends in the cafeteria. But on the fifth day of the week, well, take a listen.
Cheryl, 18 was asking about the umbilical cord. She had some questions about it.
Once a week, Longoria trades in her Catholic school uniform for a pair of light blue scrubs. She then makes her way around the birthing floor for her rounds at St. Mary's Hospital near Detroit.
Knock, knock. Do you need anything?
Good, thank you.
You're good? Sure? Okay.
It might not sound like it, but this is her homework. See, Longoria, who is 17 years old, goes to Cristo Rey. It's a college prep Catholic high school in Detroit, one of 25 around the country. The schools are specifically for low-income kids, the vast majority of whom are either Hispanic, like Longoria, or Black. Here's how it works. One day a week, beginning as freshmen, the students go to work for a white-collar company. A law firm, say, or the IT department at Chrysler. The company, in turn, agrees to pay most of the students' school tuition. Debbie Ainsworth directs the birthing center where Idalis Longoria works. She says in the beginning, she was pretty nervous about the whole arrangement. I mean, having 14-year-olds do clinical work is pretty intense. But Ainsworth is a total convert now.
We are like 60 moms for them, the poor things, you know. Wait, did you do your homework? Did you this? Did you do? You got to do better. And but it's 60 role models. Some of us are single moms. Some of us aren't. They've seen women who may have had a difficult life or a difficult road to travel, who've made something really special with their lives and are making good money and can support their families, and that they can too, you know.
There have been three graduating classes since Cristo Rey opened in Detroit. And for 3 years in a row, every single senior has been accepted to college. Still, the school can't make up for years of disadvantage most of these students face. Mike Corey is president of Detroit's Cristo Rey. He says most of the students at a school come in 1 or 2 years behind in reading and math, so getting them up to grade level is a challenge. And their standardized test scores are still below the national average. But he says the jobs program at Cristo Rey helps to start level the playing field between rich kids and poor kids.
I kind of consider the jobs program our kids' country club. So while their parents might belong to the country club where they can get referrals and recommendations to kind of open the doors for their children, our students have their job partners who are doing that exact same thing for them.
They're hiring the students for summer jobs, counseling them about which colleges to apply to, even writing up recommendations to go along with their college applications. Back at the St. Mary's Hospital Birthing Center, Idalis Longoria takes a breather between rounds to tell me how much her life has changed. Before she enrolled at Cristo Rey and started working at the hospital, she says college was sort of this abstract idea, something she only half thought about.
But then I got here and I realized how important it is and how, you know, if I want to be as successful as, you know, the people that I work here with here, then it's absolutely mandatory, and I have to do good, and I have to get into a good college at that.
Her top choice, the University of Michigan. If she gets in, she will be the first in her family to go to college and hopefully graduate. With State of Opportunity, I'm Jennifer Guerra, Michigan Radio News.
There are more single people living in the U.S. than ever before, and it appears they really, really like it. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
There's a lot of single people out there. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Bella DiPaolo, project scientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, examines whether this is a good thing for our society.
Never before have so many people been single. In the United States, for example, nearly half of all adults are unmarried, and Americans now spend more years of their adult lives not married than married. To many, the rise of single people is a cause for concern, but the research suggests something quite different. When there are more single people, we all benefit. Parents sometimes fret when their grown children are not married, yet when they need help, they are more likely to get it from their sons and daughters who are single. In their everyday lives, single people are more likely to be there for their friends, neighbors, and relatives. In contrast, when couples move in together or get married, they tend to become more insular, even if they don't have kids. People who live alone are often the life of their cities and towns. They participate more often in public events, enroll in more art and music classes, and go out to dinner more often. Single people are also up for more volunteer opportunities. All these findings shattered the stereotypes of single people as isolated and lonely and self-centered. Other popular beliefs have not fared so well either. For example, people who get married typically do not end up happier or healthier than they were when they were single. In some ways, it is the single people who are doing particularly well. For example, people who stay single care more about work that is meaningful, and they experience more personal growth. They are creating ways of living that balance solitude with sociability, and they are broadening the meanings of home and family in ways that make it more possible for all of us, not just people who are single, to live our best lives.
That was Bella DiPaolo of the University of California, Santa Barbara. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.